Houston Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. Welcome to hour number two of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Governor Charlie Baker is en route. He should be here in about 5 minutes. He was giving a press conference this morning about his new bill regarding the opioid addiction crisis, which he's obviously going to talk about with us and with you guys when he gets here.
Our number is 877-301-8970. If you want to talk directly to the governor, I would line up now. If I were you, you can email him at bprwgbh.org. But in the interim, until he gets here, he has said that I can speak for him on all issues that concern you.
Well, as we know,
so I will deal with them.
As listeners may not know, Jim, of course, did run for governor. So nonetheless, you ran for governor, and there were many people who supported you. So I think you can step into the shoes of the governor right now.
You know, we see the governor once a month for an hour in a pretty relaxed setting where he's taking all callers. You know, we often talk about how'd you like to be president, not for a second. How'd you like to be governor? This guy has now taken ownership on the opiate thing with the attorney general. It's a bipartisan thing. He's taken ownership of one of the most painful situations, a continuing situation, Department of Children and Families. The T, winter is around the corner after the disaster of last year. He owns that. I mean, it is unbelievable what you got to do if you're the chief executive of a state or a country or all those.
You have a lot hanging around your neck. You know, it's a wonder you could stand up straight.
Well, he also, what did he do last week? I don't know if he formally filed. He announced an initiative on charter schools. That's not a controversial issue in Massachusetts.
Oh, no.
Arguably one of the most polarizing issues in education and beyond. Oh, and there's that nuclear plant that's shutting in Plymouth, Pilgrim. There's 600 jobs and 600,000 homes that are served by it. What does he do about those people? Well, speaking of that, here to answer all those questions
is the governor on crutches. You know, I saw a picture of him in the paper the other day at some event on crutches. And I thought, what happened to the governor? And he is on crutches. What happened to you, Governor Baker?
I'm not exactly sure. Uh-huh. I just know that I walked around on a really sore ankle for a few days. I thought it was my Achilles. I didn't know what it was. And it just kept getting worse, and I finally went to the doctor, and he said, you have a lot of pre-existing damage in your ankles from
basketball,
and you did something to aggravate what you have left. And so a little PT, staying off them, and hopefully eventually I'll be better.
Plus, I mean, it's very hard for someone to be angry at you on an issue when you're walking
isn't it? Yeah, going in and out of Gardner Auditorium on crutches is the only way to go. Yeah.
Okay, so, Governor, we know the reason you're late is 11 o'clock. You held a press conference to file what you describe as landmark substance use legislation. Give us a summary, if you can, what you told people.
Well, there are a bunch of elements to it, maybe seven or eight, and they build on the recommendations of the task force that we had earlier in the year that made a series of recommendations about how to deal with this opioid epidemic. The two big ones, and there are a number of elements in this, I would just speak to a couple. One was a proposal to limit to 72 hours the first prescription a physician would write to somebody for opioid medication, and that would include physicians, dentists, PAs, everybody. And the other one is to create to basically take the process we currently have in place to do commitments for people with mental illness who may be a danger to themselves or others, and to basically use the same process for people who are dealing with opioid addiction so that there is a civil commitment process for them that would work the same way.
Can I ask you about the latter for a second, which I assume both those things are going to be controversial. I would argue that the involuntary confinement, for lack of a better expression, might be the most. I heard you say in the last couple of days, in anticipation of this press conference this morning, Governor, that due process will be provided.
Yeah.
But it's due process after the fact, after they have been involuntarily committed, as opposed to now, where, if I understand correctly, a health facility or a doctor or somebody, medical personnel, has to go to a court and affirmatively seek in order to commit them, correct?
If the court is open.
Right.
I mean, the other issue is, you know, hospitals are open 24/7. Courts are open Monday through Friday, usually sort of 9 to 5. So part of it's about creating a wider window for dealing with that. The second is the process that's going to be used for this is virtually identical, under our proposal anyway, is identical to the process that the is currently in place for dealing with involuntary commitments for people who are a danger to themselves as a result of mental illness. I tell you something, Jim, it's hard for me to understand. There are two things that drove us to make this proposal. One is, it's hard for me to understand how somebody who has overdosed to the point of actual death and near death in some cases, and gets Narcan back to life. And their first instinct when they get Narcan back to life, based on every conversation I've had with anybody in the ER or parents, brothers, sisters, friends, their first instinct is, because they lost their high, is to go back out onto the street and get another one. It's hard for me to understand how that shouldn't at least involve a little bit of a conversation of some kind about whether or not this person's in immediate danger to themselves. And the second issue is we have an opportunity here to create a path to treatment for some of these folks. Now, it may be after 72 hours, people just go back out on the streets and they won't be ready at that point for treatment. But I've talked to a bunch of folks who said that the fact that for whatever reason they ended up spending a little more time in the hospital than they thought they were going to spend is what got them into treatment and saved their life. And I think this is at least worth a conversation, given the fact that there are all kinds of legitimate issues around legal questions and operational questions, too.
One last thing, and only one last thing, for at least for me on this, because every single caller, without one exception, is calling about your plan, so I'm sure they'll broach most things. Putting aside the person who comes in who is non-compos mentis, the person you described who's OD'd and maybe there's a Narcan thing, yep, or whatever, someone who voluntarily goes in, are you worried that that person may not voluntarily go in for fear that they go in for some level of treatment and they find out that they are forced to stay there against their will?
Well, the only reason you can hold somebody is immediate danger to themselves or others. That's the only reason you can hold somebody now.
No, but I'm saying, but somebody might say, I'm not going to take a risk of getting voluntarily getting treatment.
I mean, if you're in a position where you're... First of all, there's a million ways for somebody in that situation to get treatment. They don't have to go to a hospital, ER, for example. There's a lot of other places they can go. They can go to, I mean, these days in many communities, they can go to the police station. I think the issue for us is for those people who have just experienced a near-death incident of their own making, who will simply, in many cases, go back out onto the street. There are dealers, literally. You talk to the hospital ER people, they will tell you there are dealers, literally, standing two blocks away from the hospital waiting for these people to come out of the hospital, okay? If somebody has a better idea, too, I'm wide open to it. But I think this is a conversation worth having.
You know, one thing, Governor Baker, before we get to the phone calls, I didn't know this, and in this bill, it says that under this Section 35, it will specify that women committed for substance use treatment may be sent to new secure treatment units approved by the Department of Public Health and the Department of Mental Health, ending the practices of sending them to MCI Framingham, which is a state prison for women. I didn't know that's where
they
went.
Okay, so since 1987, 28 years ago, the Commonwealth has said they were going to get out of the business of sending women who were involuntarily committed for addiction purposes to Framingham. That was 28 years ago. For 28 years, the state has said they're going to do it and has not changed their policy. And so if you're a woman in Massachusetts and you're an addict, and you are involuntarily committed, you are going to be sent to Framingham, where you are not going to receive treatment. And the folks at Framingham would say that they're not really in the treatment business either.
And so
the proposal that we made, and I'm very confident we're going to get this thing passed, because the money's already been adopted by both the House and the Senate to support this, is that we're going to put beds up at Shattuck Hospital, and we're going to put beds up at Taunton State Hospital, and we will have twice as many beds as they have at Framingham, and there'll be treatment beds as opposed to prison beds. And I think this is something that just needs to end, from my point of view.
Well, just from the woman perspective, one quick thing. It's not just that they don't get treatment at Framingham State Prison.
It's a prison.
It's a prison.
Yeah.
And also, if you live in Provincetown and your mother is in Framingham and these are little kids, you're not going to see your mother for a big chunk of time, which to little kids is a big deal.
Okay. Remember, on an involuntary commitment, you got to have a secure facility. And there are a limit to how many of those types of facilities we have around the Commonwealth anyway.
And but you're closer in Plymouth and Shattuck.
The facility at Shattuck and Taunton will be...
closer.
Although, as I'm sitting here thinking about it, those aren't necessarily closer if you're from Western Mass. But the whole point here for us was to put a program in place that got us out of using Framingham State Prison as the sort of solution to this. And it's kind of incredible to me that it's been on the radar for such a long period of time and nothing happened.
One last thing before the calls, Governor. You have worked really closely in bipartisan fashion with the Attorney General Maura Healey on this opiate epidemic. Is she bought in, as far as you know? Have you talked to her about this this 72-hour thing?
She's well aware of the proposals that we've made here, and we've briefed her and her staff about them. I haven't talked directly to her about it. But I think what she would – no, I'm not going to speak for her. I've talked to a lot of people in public life about these proposals over the course of the past few weeks. And to a person, they've said these are conversations that are worth having.
Fair enough. Let's
I mean,
go
think about this way. We are dealing with something that is like a rocket ship in the wrong direction. You're talking about in 2014, three, maybe four times, depending upon how you do the math, as many deaths as we had in – 2010 here in the Commonwealth. The number of overdoses just blows away that number. The numbers this year are going to be even worse than they were last year. And this kind of falls to me into the category of something where if we simply try and play this on the margin and think that we can move this by just doing a little less or a little more of this or that, we're kidding ourselves. We'll be dealing with this issue in ever greater circumstances and situations, and far more families and individuals who will be horribly affected by it for a very long time.
Let's go to the calls. That's the governor of the Commonwealth, Charlie Baker. Karen from Burlington, you were first with Governor Baker. Wait about 10 seconds, Karen, as he plugs himself in. He's doing that. Karen, welcome to Boston Public Radio.
Yeah, you got it.
He's good on opiate prescriptions, but not so good on technology. Here he is with headphones almost on. Almost on. This is rather.
Sorry.
Hi, Karen.
I'm
sorry. You're on with the governor. Hi.
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 I'm a victim of domestic violence, and I have had a broken back from my husband. We're divorced, but I live in chronic pain. And when you are limiting what people can get for opioids, it makes it difficult for people like me that suffer every single day.
And, First of all,
I used to be able to get a letter. My doctor used to be able to mail me a prescription, and now she can't. I have to physically go there, rain, snow, whatever. And that just places an extra burden on me. I didn't ask for this pain, and I'm very disappointed that it's been made harder for me to get my medication.
Well, Karen, obviously, let me just start by saying that I am really sorry to hear about the circumstance you find yourself in. And I actually talked specifically today in my comments about the difference between acute pain and chronic pain. This legislation, what we're proposing today, ought not to have any impact at all on the way chronic pain management is handled. This is about the person who has their wisdom teeth out, or the person who has a minor surgical procedure, or the person who has, who breaks an arm or a knuckle or something like that. What we're saying is, or who has a migraine, what we're saying here is the first prescription for that person for their acute pain for opioids should be limited to 72 hours. And if after 72 hours they go back to their doc and the doc says, and they and the doc agree that, there should be another prescription on that, and it should be an opioid prescription as opposed to some other form of pain medication, okay. But there are too many people walking out of a dentist's office, a doctor's office, and other healthcare providers who have what I would call acute pain that will be an issue for them for a couple of days, who are walking out with 30, 60, 90 pills. And those pills, they are very effective for dealing with chronic pain, which is a different issue, which is yours. And I just want you to know that we talked specifically today about the fact that this is not about chronic pain. This is about acute pain and that first prescription. It's got nothing to do with whatever the ongoing course of treatment is that you and your doctor have agreed to.
Karen, I hope that's comforting. Thank you much for the call. Let's go to Uxbridge, where Marianne is on with the governor of the Commonwealth. Hi.
Hi, it is Marianne.
Hi, Marianne.
Governor Baker, I applaud you. I can't even begin to tell you how much the parents of opiate addicts, the family members of opiate addicts, appreciate your efforts. I I'm a big proponent of the Section 35 process, but I'm also a nurse. And I want to know if you're aware of the problems that we have as healthcare professionals between what we know should be done in terms of giving opiate medications and what the Joint Commission for Accreditation of Hospitals forces physicians and nurses to do under their standard for pain control.
I am well aware of the fact that this whole issue really took off when the federal government decided to make pain, which is not a numerical value the way blood pressure and temperature and the original vital signs were, decided to make pain the fifth vital, and that became something that became kind of a judgment call among all the players. And you look at all the information, and it's pretty clear the minute they did that, the number of prescriptions written for opioids went through the moon. I am well aware of that. I mean, I don't know how to. I would be interested in thoughts people have, Marianne, about how to tackle that one, which is a federal issue. But I certainly believe that here in the Commonwealth, I'm thrilled to hear that this is something you're paying attention to. But one of the things I also said today at the press conference, I've been surprised by how casual a lot of my former colleagues in the healthcare world are about this whole issue. I mean, I don't think they get the significance. I think they appreciate the value and the upside associated with a lot of these medications. I don't think they think that hard about the downside. And the fact that you can graduate from medical school or nursing school or dental school without ever taking a course in addiction kind of tells you something about that. And we've met with the medical schools, and they made pretty clear to us that, oh, yeah, we have curriculum. Well, is it a requirement, you know, for graduate? No, it's not. Is it even like a core competency? Well, actually, no, it's not. So how many people actually like take the course? Well, people who are going to be dealing very particularly and specifically with that do. But that's a really limited number of folks. So I guess what I would say, Marianne, is our goal here is to try to raise the level of awareness for families, for patients, and for practitioners. And if I can come up with a really bright idea about how to engage the larger conversation you're talking about, I will pursue it. And if you have thoughts on that, you should let us know.
Marianne, thank you very much for the call. Let's go to Michael.
Hey, what was the number of, was it 225 million?
He's talking to a coworker since you're not
that Mary Lou
him.
Put out there today, the number of class Schedule 2 and Schedule 3 medication pills that were written this past year in 14. 225 million Schedule 2, Schedule 3 pills were prescribed
where?
In Massachusetts.
What are Schedule 2? What are Schedule 2, Schedule 3? Opioids?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, it is true.
225 million. We have 6 million people.
Now you go in for broken toe and they send you out with a whole box, you know, prescription full of these pills.
It's not a good
pills.
Thing.
Let's go to Michael. You're in a car, but you have pulled over. Thank you for that. Michael, you're on with the governor of the Commonwealth. Hi, Michael.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call, and thank you, Governor, for taking my question. I appreciate all of your attention to the opiate issue that's in Massachusetts. It's an extremely important issue. But I'd like to talk about energy, and in particular solar.
Yep.
I met you at a fundraiser back in March, and I spoke with you about it and your concerns about the ratepayers being affected by the cost of solar. And I talked to you about how, well, if we really want to change the rate of electricity, let the private utility companies buy the electricity in long-term blocks instead of six-month blocks. You know, the solar issue now with Pilgrim closing, we have so much momentum going in solar, and it seems the appearance is that you and Speaker DeLeo are holding up the net meter cap bills. And I know you have one of your own, but it only raises it 2%. I mean, if we look at California, Governor Brown just put into law that they want 50% of their electricity coming from renewables by 2020. Why can't we do the same thing here? Senator Markey was on the radio yesterday saying that we have 100,000 jobs in Massachusetts from renewable energy sector. I mean, we have gained tremendous strides in putting in clean energy in this state. And now you and Speaker DeLeo are holding it up.
Michael,
and
why. You've made your point. Let's hear what the governor has to say in response. Thank you, Michael.
As Michael pointed out, we did file a bill to lift the cap, which is what he's referring to. And this would get really esoteric for your listeners if we got too far into the weeds on this. What I will say is that we do support lifting the cap. And And we support the previous administrations and the legislative goal of getting to 1,600 megawatts of solar by 2020. I think we believe that we can get there by 2018 if we lift the cap along the terms of what we've proposed. But we are certainly interested in seeing the legislature act on a solar bill, and for a number of reasons. One is there's a big tax credit that expires for at the federal level that expires at the end of 16, and I would hate for us to miss out on that opportunity. And the second is we do have an opportunity to continue to be a national leader on this. The one thing I would say, Michael, in response to your comments, is whether you're talking about solar or you're talking about energy efficiency, there's pretty much no state in the country that spends more on those programs than we do. And the spending is paid for by the ratepayers. And I am certainly interested in seeing us continue to grow the solar footprint and to expand our energy efficiency initiatives and to continue to be a national leader on those. But we need to recognize and understand that we are also the third or fourth highest cost state in the country for electricity. And that has consequences for us when it comes to employment and people's ability to pay their bills. And we just have to keep that in mind. It's part of the reason why the hydro thing is so interesting to me and why we filed a hydro bill along with our solar bill to at least test the waters, and that's pun intended, to figure out if the hydro that's currently available domestically or in Canada can be a source of clean, sustainable, renewable energy here in New England at a price that's affordable and reasonable. And this is something, by the way, this is also a bipartisan issue. You talk to the governors of the rest of the New England states, who are Democrats and Republicans, they are all anxious to see us engage in a pretty significant effort to test the hydro waters.
You know, Governor Baker, obviously,
Michael, thank you.
Speaking of energy, the announced shutdown of the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant is going to figure in dramatically to people's energy costs. I know you talked about possibly expanding natural gas, but what are we going to do without the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant?
Well, Pilgrim, there's a couple things for people to remember here. The first is, if they close the facility, when they close the facility, it's sort of a 2018-2019 time frame, which is, you know, a ways from now.
Yep.
So there's runway. There's runway for the people who work there. There's runway for the town of Plymouth. There's runway for the grid, the New England energy electricity grid that's run by ISO, which we all participate in. I would say a couple of things. The first is the thing that makes Pilgrim so important to the region, which is different than solar and wind, for example, is it's always on 24/7, 365. It almost never shuts off. And because it's there, it's always there. And, you know, solar's there when the sun shines and solar's there when the wind blows. But there's a baseload capacity issue associated with Pilgrim that we have to compensate for. And part of what makes the hydro piece so appealing to me is that is baseload capacity. It would be the kind of capacity that would be there 24/7, 365 every day when you turn on the lights, in your or you know, use electricity in any way. And I would hope that this will make the opportunity to test the waters on hydro a little more attractive to people. But we have time here, I guess, is my fundamental point. The big thing I want to make sure we do in the short term, and the Globe talked about this today in their editorial, we have to make sure that all the issues associated with decommissioning are done safely, properly, and appropriately. And that's something we need to do in conjunction with the folks at Energy and the folks at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, because that in the short term is really the big issue.
We're talking to Charlie Baker, governor of the Commonwealth. I'll be here to one. Before we take a break, Governor, two quick education things. You have either filed or announced you're going to file or some such thing, a bill on charters. My understanding, up to 12 additional in underperforming districts and special preferences for admission for non-English speakers, a whole variety of classes of students,
yep,
who theoretically have been discriminated against by charters. One question, then one related question. Do you see any possibility of getting this through the Senate, or is this just so that you can say you tried so that you can support the ballot question and tell the people, I don't mean this disrespectfully, and say to the people, we tried, we can't get it through the legislature, now you got to do it on the ballot. Is that what it's about, or no?
No, I think, Senate President Stan Rosenberg has had two Senate caucuses so far on the charter school stuff, and I think he's going to have a third one. He brought in a bunch of the charter school operators to meet with the members of the Senate. He brought in a bunch of anti-charter folks, I think this week, to talk to members of the Senate as well. He's got another caucus next week. I mean, he's taken this pretty seriously, and Senator Chang Diaz has made quite clear that she would like to work with people on this one and see if it's possible to do something that meets the criteria that she would consider important to solve this. She has some of the best charter schools in Massachusetts located in her district.
She's seen as a pretty serious obstacle historically to anything happening. Is that not a fair statement?
That is a fair statement, but she asked some terrific questions at the hearing. And by the way, the hearing went on for a very long time. There were a ton of folks from all over the Commonwealth, mostly parents from low-income communities who came to the Statehouse and spent the day there waiting for their opportunity to testify on why this is important to them and to their kids and to their neighborhoods. And I don't think we should ever lose sight of the fact that we have 37,000 kids on waiting lists to get into charter schools in Massachusetts. Farrah Stockman wrote a really interesting piece in the Boston Globe over the weekend that basically said that the performance of charter schools in Boston, most of which serve primarily African-American and Latino populations, has completely flipped upside down the whole notion of what it takes to deliver a great education in Boston. And I just think if we're serious about giving every kid the kind of opportunity that they deserve to get a great education, I don't see how we can't have this conversation.
Yeah, but it's not. But with all due respect, it's not every kid. Let's assume you're right on everything you say about charter schools. 3% of the students go to charter schools. Let's assume you get your 12. What's that make it? 4%? And so even if they get wonderful education, 96% of the kids are in schools that you think aren't matching the performance of those 4%. So we're talking almost a generation lost while we continue to fight this charter school fight.
Well, you got to think about it a little differently than that. I mean, I would argue that, and I think the data would support me on this, that the Education Reform Act of 1993 has accomplished many of its major objectives. We are still the only state that's ever finished first on the National Assessment of Educational Progress exam in English and math, and we've done it 5 times, okay? If we were a country, our science scores for our high school seniors would rank us among the top 10 countries in the world. I mean, the notion that there hasn't been, as a result of the funding, the foundation funding formula and the curriculum frameworks and the high standards and the test and assessment regimen, the notion that that hasn't had an impact on education in Massachusetts is just not true. It has, because we were right in the middle of the pack, despite the fact that we're a fairly well-educated and fairly high-income state, forever. And the last 20 years, 25 years, 23 years has been a game changer with respect to that. And many cities in Massachusetts have seen significant improvements in their performance. And career and technical schools have seen significant improvement in the performance of their kids. The number of kids who graduate, the number of kids who go on to 2-year and 4-year schools. I mean, there's a ton of great evidence out there. And even in Boston, the Boston schools are much better today than they were before education reform passed. So for me, the charter question is partially about the fact that they do create competition and many communities have responded to it. They have done some things that are interesting, especially the lengthening of the school day, which Mayor Walsh, to his credit and to the teachers union credit in Boston, got negotiated into their new contract. And I can't overstate, for me anyway, the importance of having 37,000 kids and their parents sitting on a waiting list trying to get into one of these. And I'll tell you something. You listen to a guy like Rodolfo Aguilar, who spoke at the press conference we had at the Brook Middle School. He has 2 kids in that school, K-8. He doesn't know what's going to happen when they go to high school. And I just don't think that's fair. I just don't think it's fair.
You know what I want to ask? What is this fight really about? Because it's very contentious, it's very passionate. What's it really about?
I think some of it is about disruption. I do think some of it is some of it's like Uber, okay? Some of it's a fight about the old model and the new model. And, you know, a lot of people who believe the old one is good and the new one is not. And some people who believe the old model is bad and the new one is good. And I think for a bunch of people who are involved in this fight, it's about that. I think the second piece is the funding formula, which we've said we're perfectly happy to work with people to try to figure out What is the consequence of the money as it moves around?
So the regular schools won't lose as much money.
Yeah, although the thing people need to remember here is, you know, all of the schools that are involved in this conversation are funded by some combination of state and local money, all of them. And the kids all live in the same neighborhoods. So to some extent, at a high level, this one this one really is about the details. And I think it's a conversation worth having. And I think the third issue is, and I get this one as well, and I understand why it's an issue, but I'm on my side of it and others are on the other. Charter schools are regulated by the Commonwealth, not by the local school district. And so for a bunch of folks, if you're the mayor or you're on the school committee in any city in Boston, the fact that the charter schools are regulated by the Commonwealth and not by the school committee and the mayor is a problem. And I get that and understand
that. But don't
leave
local citizens out. You're a big local government kind of guy.
Yes,
I
am.
Served as an alderman.
Yeah,
you lose
a selectman.
Whatever you were. And I know you had the most votes ever, and I heard in that. But you lose your ability to hold those people accountable. You're the people closest to you. But we only have a second left before we have to take a break. One other education thing quickly. You've told us repeatedly, speaking of education reform and the testing that came out of that, you were the only person who testified. Was it against Common Core? Is that what you told us in the past?
2010, yep.
Early results are in terms of whether these park tests, without giving people a headache, these newer tests are better at preparing kids for college readiness, and it appears they're not better.
Where do I go to do my superior
dance?
Well,
the Board of Secondary Education is going to be making a decision next month. Are you going to preempt that? I mean, well, I shouldn't say preempt. Are you going to speak as to what you think the outcome should be before that board speaks, based upon your beliefs and based upon these recent results?
So a lot of the Common Core opponents came to me literally right after I won and said you hated Common Core. You need to get rid of it, right? And I said to them, I didn't like it, but I also said that one of the reasons I didn't like it was we spent 2 years debating the MCAS infrastructure and how MCAS was going to work. And Common Core was delivered as a fait accompli with no public debate. I mean, they had one meeting, which is the one I spoke at and opposed it. That's all the process there was in Massachusetts before we jumped into the Common Core end of the pool. And so I said to all the opponents, I said, I want to have the conversation we never gave the people in Massachusetts back in 2010. And so what I basically said to the board, I want you to have hearings, I want you to test this, I want you to kick the tires on it, and I want you to prepare that data, gather it up, hear from the public, from school administrators, parents, and others, and then share it with the members of the board, and then do what you think makes the most sense for Massachusetts. The only piece of guiding advice I gave them is I don't want to end up in a situation where we do not control our own destiny. First of all, it's our money, okay? The vast majority of the money we spend on K-12 and education in Massachusetts is state and local money. It's not federal money. And I want to be sure that a state that values and appreciates education above practically everything else doesn't lose its ability to set its own course and chart its own direction when it comes to educating kids. And that's pretty much the guidance I've given them.
That's all the guidance you'll give them prior to this meeting in November.
That's kind of where I am at this point, yeah.
Okay, fair enough. He's the governor of the Commonwealth.
And he is Charlie Baker, and he's with us till the top of the hour. Our number is 877-301-8970. Our email is bpr@wgbh.org. Quick break, right back.
Brazil may be the soccer capital of the world, but for young women, it is not a level playing field.
When I started playing, I did feel like there was a lot of prejudice. They called me a macho girl. They called me a lesbian.
Brazilian teenage girls fight for the right to play. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4, here on 89.7 WGBH.
WGBH programs are here thanks to you and the Museum of Fine Arts. Now on view, Dutch painting in the age of Rembrandt and Vermeer, featuring rare masterpieces from around the world that paint the story of the Dutch Golden Age. For more information, you can visit mfa.org. And Boston Children's Hospital, Pediatric Innovation Summit and Awards, November 9th and 10th, 2015. Shaping the future of pediatric medicine. You can find more information online at takingontomorrow.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan, and more importantly, to 1 o'clock, the governor of the Commonwealth. Governor, if you like listening to yourself, sure. Here is a discussion. No, it's a discussion you and I had last month, and you said you were going to think about the topic. So here is me, and then this would be the governor. Here it is. You know, you're a big ballot question supporter, which I admire. So am I. I'm a huge direct democracy guy. If a person came up to you with the marijuana ballot question, which you will vote no on, should it make it on the ballot, and said, will you please sign this to help us get it before the voters?
You know, it's funny.
Would you do it?
I don't know. I've thought about that. I don't know. I haven't. I've thought about that.
Now, before you leave.
I'm assuming at some point that may, in fact, happen. If it does, I'll let you know what I
did. Fair enough. What's going to happen right now? Because in my left hand, I'm not saying what my position is. In my left hand, Governor, is a petition to amend the Constitution to allow the state to tax millionaires at a higher rate. That's this one. And in my right hand is one of the, I guess, several questions that would legalize recreational marijuana. We know you oppose both, but you're a huge direct democracy person. Would you like to sign either of these?
Yeah, give them to me.
Okay. The governor is taking them right there. This is Governor Charlie Baker. And do you want to say something while you're signing them or not?
No, I did think about this, and I decided that if I really believe in this process, I should sign these things. So
absolutely.
I'm going to sign them.
And, sign away. Here
and
it
I'm,
is.
And I'm going to figure out which ones you're opposed to, and I'm bringing them in next month, and I'm going to make you
that
sign
them.
That
is a fair deal. We're talking to Charlie Baker.
I'm going to Colorado in a few weeks. You know, I can bring back some lozenges, some marijuana lozenges.
By the way, for those
I think I might get arrested at the airport, though. Maybe I better not.
Well, excellent photog Lance is videoing this, and you'll probably see it at some night on Greater Boston. The governor is signing both petitions, and if I may, as of the moment, you plan to vote against both of them. Is that correct, Governor?
Probably. I mean, I'm not a big tax increase guy, but this one in particular, the constitutional amendment, has a long way to go. So we have plenty of time to think about that one. I am definitely going to vote against this
one.
But
you are signing to get it before the people. Fair enough. The governor signed it. Let's go back to the...
That was lovely, Jim.
To the Coles. Yeah, it was a setup kind of thing.
That's a total act of bad faith.
That's beautiful. No, I was just following up on what you said you were going to address. Let's go to Sheila Norton. You're on with the governor of the Commonwealth. That, of course, is Charlie Baker. Hi, Sheila.
Hi, and Governor, I agree with you on the marijuana, to not have it legalized. I also wanted to thank you for the sense of urgency that is clear in your efforts to address the opiate scourge. And if I could be indulged, I had three thoughts or concerns about it, if I could just let you know that one would be in a recent situation that I'm aware of, a college has certain procedures in place that delayed the Narcan being given to a student. Because a dorm student couldn't give a 911 call, and as it turned out, he had to go through a process to the RA, and then the RA went through something, and the delay caused the death of the college student. And I'm wondering, excuse me, if you have put into place some effort through the colleges to handle this crisis there. Secondly, with hospice and what is given to people in their last days, there is a lot of opiates given. And then they are left with the families, and we are left to give them over to, like, the police and law enforcement, which they don't seem to be very monitored. It bothers me that in giving over almost like a bag full of opiates, I handed them over to someone, and there was no documentation. And I thought that that might not be a smart thing, because evidence is always sort of documented and kept, and I just thought it should be something more monitored.
Sheila, can I hold you there only
those are both really good points.
Let the governor speak to both
of you.
You can't
call 911 from a college
campus.
Well,
I'm obviously going to do some homework with my Secretary of Education about this, but there should be in place college, and I hope this is an exception to the rule. I would hope most colleges have in place, particularly for life-threatening situations like this, the ability for people to call 911.
Everyone has cell phones. I don't understand that.
I don't know. I'll find out. And on the other one, I think that's a really interesting question she's raising about, by the way, our legislation presumes that people who are in hospice, people who are in cancer treatment, stuff like that, that is the chronic pain part. And from our point of view, they should just do what they've done and will continue to do. But her larger issue about that, we have a huge problem everywhere associated with too many of these pills just hanging around in people's medicine chests and drawers and just all kinds of places. And one of the main issues associated with a lot of breaking and entering, some of it's about looking for jewelry and stuff like that, but a big piece of it is about looking for this stuff. And we had an event a few weeks ago, which was a take-back event, and the whole point of it, and we did it with the Realtors Association and a bunch of other folks. Apparently, a lot of folks now go to open houses specifically to rummage around inside people's medicine chests to try to find opioids.
Incredible.
So anything we can do to get this stuff out of people's houses if someone's no longer in treatment, we should do.
Sheila, thanks for the call. Governor, thank you. Let's go to Margaret. You're in Weymouth. My apologies, I couldn't read it. Hi, Margaret. You're on with the governor.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was at a meeting on Tuesday in Weymouth given by the Spectre Gas Company, and I spoke to an environmental engineer because we're very concerned with the proposed two gas compressors underneath the Four River Bridge, and I'm very concerned with air quality. And I asked him about the upcoming EPA air quality test that Spectra will do. And I said, what about the 36,000 cars a day that go across the Four River Bridge, all emitting their own fumes, and will there be a synergistic interaction between the emissions of the compressor? And he said, oh, that's not part of an EPA air quality study, that they only study stationary objects. So the 36,000 cars a day are mobile and are not included in any air quality study. So I thought, gee, well, that's not a very good study. How will we ever be able to know whether it's safe or not if it's at least incomplete?
Okay.
So I was wondering, would you be able to use your influence to include the cars in the EPA study?
Okay, Margaret, first of all, you're absolutely right on virtually every piece of information you just put out on that, right down to the 36,000 cars. Let me do some homework on this one and find out what the story is there. I understand the issue exactly as you are phrasing it, and I'll have to look into it. It could be they misunderstood your question. It could be somebody else does it. Let me just see if I can get you an answer to that. But that's a really good question.
Do you want her to get us to take a number
sure.
on that? Margaret, can you hold on 1 second? One of our producers will get contact information for you, and the governor's office will be back to you. Margaret, you want to take the next call? Thanks, Margaret. Oh, you can't see it. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I can't see it.
Susan, you're in Harvard. My apologies.
I can't see it?
Well, because it's turned towards
you.
Oh, I see.
I was turning it to the governor. See,
hey,
there you go,
thank
Governor
you.
Baker.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah.
Susan, you're in Harvard. You're on with Governor Baker. Hi. I was going to say hi, Governor. Hello, Susan.
Hi. Good afternoon, Governor Baker, Marjorie, and Jim.
Yeah.
I am a patient that suffers from chronic pain. I'm also a registered nurse, and I've testified at the State House about issues about chronic pain, and there's a lot of talk about how the legislation is not going to penalize people that have chronic pain, but the laws actually have had a dramatic effect on the chronic pain population, and the thought process seems to have become that opioids equal addiction. So anybody that takes an opioid is an addict or is shortly going to become an addict and needs to be monitored closely. I know that the pain provider that I was going to decided no longer to be writing pain prescriptions for me and sort of shoved me off on my primary care doctor. And my primary care doctor said, well, why should I write it? Because they're the pain people, and I'm stuck in the middle. And then when I was able to get somebody to write for my pain medication, the pharmacists are sort of unwilling to fill the prescriptions. I had a pharmacist say to me that she wouldn't fill the prescription until she got my diagnosis code, you know, because she's going to decide that she'll fill the prescription if my diagnosis meets her standard.
Susan, thank you for the call. I should point out, Governor Baker, we're getting a lot of emails kind of saying what Susan is saying, that they are people with chronic pain, various illnesses, and they are having a lot of problems. Now either their physicians are skittish, the pharmacy's skittish, so maybe the law doesn't affect them, but there seems to be this sense in the air.
One of the things, I can't remember if I mentioned this on the show or not, I definitely mentioned it at the press conference. I've been surprised by how little education around addiction and pain management there is as part of a traditional medical school, nursing school. I mean, This isn't like a core requirement. Nobody has to take a course in pain management or addiction to become a doctor or a nurse or, in many cases, even a dentist. And I don't get that. I mean, it seems to me that this should be kind of part of the core curriculum, especially given the fact that pain is now the fifth vital sign, which it's been now for 15 years or so. And it's a huge part of what goes on inside most of our healthcare institutions. And I think one of the things our legislation does do is it requires clinicians to up the number of hours they spend getting continuing education credits in pain management and addiction. And we're going to start putting people who are pain management and addiction specialists on our Board of Registration of Medicine, dentistry, nursing, and all the rest. And I think one of the things I'm hoping comes about as a result of this type of, I mean, people get skittish about stuff they don't think they know that much about.
Yeah, what should these people do? I guess
understand.
That's the issue. Do they tell their doctors that they're wrong or their pharmacists that they're wrong? What do,
well,
what
I do
they
think,
do?
I do think part of it is we need to do more to encourage and, if need be, require practitioners to engage in this conversation in a more serious and significant way than they have before. I think if they were better educated about this, they might feel differently about it with respect to some of the issues that are being raised by the folks with chronic pain. But that said, what we're proposing today doesn't change anything, I guess, positively or negatively with respect to chronic pain, except that we are going to start requiring a higher level of education for existing practitioners around pain management addiction.
Should not be going through this. This is a misunderstanding or a fault on the pharmacist's side or her physician's side or a pain management person. I mean, she should not have to be jumping through these extended hoops.
Well, I would like to find out what the story is with the pharmacist stuff.
Yeah.
And that's an easy one for us to look into because, first of all, the data is a lot easier to find. And secondly, there are a number of places you can go to engage that conversation.
Governor,
we'll look into.
That's the voice of the governor. Governor, I was watching the Democratic debate the other night. Did you watch it?
I was late getting home from a charity thing, but I turned it on when I got home. So I saw maybe the last 45 minutes.
Well, you will find this hard to believe, but as I'm watching it, you know who I'm thinking of? You. And here's my question. Is it not fair to say that your politics are closer to Hillary Clinton's than they are to the three leaders on the Republican side, Fiorina, Carson, and Donald Trump? I mean that seriously. This is not like a setup question. Isn't that a fair statement?
There are plenty of people who are running for president, Jim, who I agree with on some stuff and disagree with on others. And we are still pretty early in this process.
But
we have a long way to go.
Take the two front runners just for a second. Trump crushing leads in Nevada and South Carolina. We read in the polls last night. Hillary Clinton on the Democratic side. You are closer politically to the lead Democrat than you are to the lead Republican.
I think at this point in time, we have a long way to go. And I agree with some of these folks on some things. And I don't agree with some of them on lots of other things. And the good news for your listeners is I spend most of my time worrying about what's going on around here. I don't spend a lot of my time focused on what's going on at the presidential level because in addition to the fact that no one elected me to worry about presidential politics, we're still pretty early in that process. There's a long way to go.
We are. But speaking of that, actually, the second most emailed topic so far during the show, the opiate thing, is by far the first, as Marjorie said, is around gambling things. Very quickly, before we go back to the Coles, have you thought at all about whether or not there's any role, any thing you can do around this unregulated billion-dollar fantasy sports industry? I know they're looking at insider trading. I know they're looking at whether or not the federal government, the law really has an exemption. Is there any role for you?
You know, I've asked we've spent most of our time sort of deferring to the Attorney General on some of the legal questions associated with this. And I have to believe that if you win in DraftKings or FanDuel or any of these and you live in Massachusetts, that's income that you have to report.
I would assume.
And you get taxed on it. But I would say that, you know, what started is this. I mean, I got kids who play in silly little fantasy football leagues that they put together with their friends. I think this thing is light years ahead of anybody's ability to figure out what the right role for government is in terms of regulation and oversight. I think some of the issues that the AG is raising about consumer protection are legit, and the fact that you now have other people investigating some more serious charges about this, I guess what I would say, Jim, is I've told people in my shop, I want to get a lot smarter about this over the course of the next couple of months than I am today. And I do feel like we are way behind our basic understanding about how this works and what the consequences are.
One last gambling question. Have you changed your position in terms of giving at least your public opinion to the Gaming Commission about whether or not they should award a license in southeastern Mass in light of what happened with the Native American tribe down there?
There's still a long way to go on that process, and we set this up as a commonwealth to be run by the Gaming Commission, and the Gaming Commission gets to make the call.
Okay, Peter in New Bedford, you're on with the governor of the Commonwealth. Hi, Peter. Peter?
We've lost Peter.
Okay.
Which allows me
Sorry,
to ask
Peter.
A question.
Sure.
A lot of people have also been emailing about DCF. You've hired a medical director.
Yep.
Why is this a big deal?
Well, first of all, I'd say three things. The first thing is this has been an open issue and a sore spot for people who follow DCF and its activities for a long time. This is, I think, the first medical director that's been hired by the department. Also happens to be a terrific medical director with a great reputation and a ton of sort of clinical validity coming into the organization, and also comes from a UMass Medical, which is a very complex institution and probably knows their way around complex institutions.
And she's worked with foster kids
absolutely.
For years.
So I'm pretty excited about it. And I think the three big things we get here is we get somebody who will bring a clinical understanding and a clinical knowledge based on experience and education and all the rest to this conversation and clinical knowledge that we've just never had. And I think that's going to be tremendously helpful to everybody at every level in the organization, all the way down to sort of frontline social workers. Second issue is, as I said, it's been a huge sore spot for people that there wasn't a clinical lead at the department, especially as the kids and the cases have gotten more and more complicated over the years. I think this will help a lot. And I also think it's going to help us do a better job of thinking about how to link a lot of what goes on the health side with a lot of these kids and their families more directly to what's going on what I would call kind of the social work side. And the third thing is we have always talked about creating clinical leadership inside the department as a commonwealth. I mean, for as long as I can remember, 10 years, 15 years, and this is the first time we're actually pulling the trigger and bringing somebody in and giving them the latitude to build the kind of clinical best practice infrastructure and guidelines and policy that I think the department needs.
We have 90 seconds. Peter, 30 seconds of that is yours from New Bedford. Hi, Peter. Quickly, please.
Yes, sir. Okay, thank you. Governor, thank you a lot. I used to be a member of the state police. I worked in the 90s with an exclusively unit that specialized in opiate drug abuse. We work closely with the Board of Pharmacy, medicine, nursing, doctors. And I recently found out that unit has been disbanded. It no longer exists. It was a great asset for all of these issues that you're talking about. And I wanted to just make you aware of it. And maybe you could look into it and see what happened to that unit and why it's no longer around.
Peter, I will look into that. I'll ask, in fact, that's a question I'll ask Secretary Bennett about today. Part of the reason we were so excited about hiring Colonel McCune to be the colonel of the state police was because his background was in investigatory activity, and he had built up terrific relationships over the course of his law enforcement career with a lot of folks in local government, law enforcement, and the courts, and we want to be helpful to people on investigatory activity, and we want to be a collaborator. So I will look into what happened to that unit.
Peter, thank you for the call.
Governor Charlie Baker, thank you very much for coming in and talking with us today. Charlie Baker joins us.
Signing a few petitions.
That's right. Jim will have a few more for you next.
I'm going to bring some ones in that he's not going to like, in addition. Get him to sign.
Next month.
I did get my left-handed day proclamation.
Yes.
I was very happy
yes.
about that because I noticed you signed those proclamations, those lists with your left hand. And as we all know, left-handers have a certain edge over the rest of the world. Okay. Thank you very much for joining us, Governor Baker.
Good
coming
to see
up,
you, Governor.
People
thank
love
you.
Whole Foods for its locally sourced food, but not so much for its outsourced labor, as in prison workers. Former Suffolk County Sheriff Andrew Cabral joins for that and more next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
On your mark, get set, go!
It's time to pick up the pace for public broadcasting. It's the first annual WGB.